This is the Brilliant Podcast. This is episode 38. And I'm here having a conversation with Julio, who is our guest host today.
Hello.
Hey. So, Julio.
Hey.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm a lifelong resident of Los Angeles, California. It's where I was born, it's where I was raised. I identify as a Chicano in my own way. I also identify with anti-politics, and I like, you know, playing with those two and see how they relate and how they don't relate. And I guess that's kind of been my lifelong project for as long as I've been interested in, you know, anti-political ideas and action.
Yeah, that term is something that I think hasn't been fleshed out enough, or there hasn't been enough expression of it. Were you first exposed to it through the web board, the anti-politics web board, or did you find it a different way?
I found it through people I met who are now, you know, longtime friends who were Chicano, who were anarchists, who were also very close to what used to be called like the post-left anarchist milieu. So that's where I came across the idea of anti-politics and what it means, and you know, and the idea of, you know, anti-politics as a kind of like critical tool to like take things apart.
Yeah, I think that, you know, of course, when the term first came about, at least in my understanding, you know, there was this desperate yearning for how do we talk about something that seemed to be a nice umbrella to cover a whole bunch of different tendencies. Like at the time of the board, the there were primitivists, there were ultra-left communist types, post-left anarchists, and some sort of anarchists without cards or something, like, you know, who were sort of maybe a bit more red, but they weren't doctrinaire. And but it never really seemed like as a term or as a sort of like a flag to fly, it never sort of came to anything, the term. But I'm really thinking about it a lot right now. In the face of sort of the new politics since November 8th or whatever, seems like the, you know, old fashioned activism is really rearing its head, and people who should know better seem to be just racing along with it.
No, I agree. I definitely agree.
Yes, as I was preparing for this conversation, I was listening to some other podcasts. And you know, sort of the anarchist space now has a good half dozen podcasts, but pretty much all of them, this podcast aside, are very much focused on, you know, what I would just call activist politics.
And also,
definitely, you know, a lot of people twittering with excitement about the events of Portland and the terms that are used in these podcasts are so detached from reality, it's hard to determine what's true and what's not. But, you know, the declaration was that, you know, 10 days ago or so, Portland had a damn near insurrection protesting the election of Donald Trump. And I just don't believe it. It's just hard for me. And it's hard for me to grasp with any sort of intentional thinking about, I guess, our daily lives, how we want to be together, that has shit all to do with this election. And it just seems like the fight against Donald Trump is going to live near our doorstep for now, the next 4 years.
No, I agree. I think, you know, from what I've been seeing in Los Angeles since his election, there's been a lot of things like movement, people in the streets. And I think what's interesting about it, the way it manifests in L.A., is that it's not, at least like during like the night, at least it seems like at night, it's mostly people who Donald Trump, you know, openly put the target on. So I think, you know, it's different than what I imagine Portland would be, which is, you know, mostly white leftists or anarchists, you know, doing their thing. So when I heard about what happened in Portland, I was like, oh, you know, that's kind of cool. But I was kind of more into seeing, like, Latino kids from the hood walking out en masse, and they kept doing it and doing it and doing it, and, like, disrupting things and being, you know,
rowdy,
you know, that's a lot more exciting to me than, you know, than people who, you know, have a certain, like, position and happen to do some stuff, you know.
Yeah, I guess I think about DuPont in this moment, and you know, DuPont's sort of statements about what's the difference between being a revolutionary and a pro-revolutionary, and in this moment that seems to be crystal clear that pretty much everybody involved is really just being a pro-revolutionary, and you know, there's no doubt that neither Jill Stein nor Hillary Clinton are going to call for guerrilla warfare against Donald Trump, and and really, like, to what end is any of this? Like, whether it's the kids of Los Angeles walking out of class, or the white people of Portland sipping pumpkin lattes while marching down the street, to what end? In other words, like, this is like spectacle time spectacle. Like, first of all, you know, voting is this sort of inconsequential act, and then, you know, being very upset about the candidate who was chosen from the very enclaves where that person absolutely wasn't chosen from. In other words, you know, from deep blue state country, people being very grumpy about the reddest candidate ever or something.
Yeah.
You know, all this just seems like delusional thinking that has no strategic or, it's all just sort of moral hand-wringing writ large.
No, absolutely. I mean, this is the this is kind of the reason why, you know, I'm not interested in calling Donald Trump a fascist, because I think a lot of it's like boogeyman words. Yeah. You know, Donald Trump could be a very terrible person and not be a fascist. And that's something that I think some people don't even want to think about, because think it, you know, it calls into question, you know, why hasn't there been anything happening before Donald Trump, you know? Right. And why hasn't there been any other kind of, like, large actions? Because, you know, he's still not even president, and shit's terrible. Like, it's very weird. Now it's terrible. Now it's frightening. And I think a lot of it has to do with now white liberals see themselves as a target. And that's where this sort of moral panic and, like, actual, like, fear is that now we are the target, just like everyone else has been the target. You know,
yeah, it's hard to say. You know, I for all the things to be terrified around Donald Trump, I'm not exactly sure his organizational skills are up to the task of managing a 400 million people FEMA camps and whatnot. But
I don't think
but you know, I guess just to finalize any further conversation about Trump, I will say that it's a little surprising to me. The lack of outrage, I guess, other than on the internet, with the people who Donald Trump is choosing to have around. I actually had left open the possibility that Donald was going to surprise everybody and make lots of sort of really loopy choices that were going to be all over the map. But it does seem like his loopy choices are almost entirely from the right, which is really scary.
No, it is. Yeah, I think that's... When I talk to people about Trump, I'm like, what's frightening is not necessarily him, because I don't think he's, like you say, he's like this great leader. He's like a rabble rouser. He's not a leader.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's more about who he's going to pick to, you know, actually do, you know, move the gears and get the machine going, you know.
He, you know, it's, not to speak of what you do for a living, but I know that this will interest you. I grew up in Western Michigan, as you may or may not know. The people who sort of rule that part of the country, they're Dutch Reformed Christians, which is sort of a particularly virulent form of Calvinism, and they own this corporation called the Amway Corporation, which is this really bizarre, you know, pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
Well, that family that owns the Amway Corporation and sort of rules that part of the country, they're called the DeVosses. And the character that Trump has just picked for the Secretary of Education is a DeVos. She's like the wife of the current leader of the corporation, or like, it's unclear exactly where the lines begin and end with those people. But it's very clear it's going to be a horror show for anyone who sort of works for a school, because she is like, she's never sent a child to public school. She's given like $200 million to the effort against public schools. Like, it's going to be quite amusing to see.
That's the scary part. To see what's going to happen.
So tell me a little bit about Los Angeles and your experience with it as a town, and is it getting better? Is it getting more interesting or less?
I think, you know, from afar, I think probably people see it as a place where there's more activity, whether like leftist goes, you know, leftist type activity. And there is more, because there is a sort of, the beginnings of a reaction against what I will call, you know, the old school, like Chicano guard in Los Angeles. So, and I think it stems from the anti-gentrification struggle in Boyle Heights, where, you know, you have, I mean, you have all kinds of people. You have like real basic leftists, you have, you know, straight out Maoists, you have some like left anarchists who, you know, who are also Chicano and who are like, well, we don't care that much about Chicano art or Chicano culture. We care more about like defense against capitalism and indecisive gentrification. We care more about being pushed out. We care more about like these like more like self-defense measures and to a certain degree like offensive measures than an institution that is like a self-help graphics. And I think, so there is a lot more activity when it comes to that. But generally speaking, you know, LA is still pretty fractured when it comes to anything, you know, looking like anarchists. So it's kind of a weird place to try to do something because everyone, I'm sure it's like the Bay Area is the same where everyone already has their clique, everyone has their crew, and they don't really talk to each other. And I get why.
It's an incredibly geographically disparate community, right?
No, absolutely. And I think a lot of it has to do with, there's even like cultural norms that change when you travel through the city. You know, like the people who live on the west side are like one thing, and the people that live in the valley are their own thing, and the people that live in South LA is one thing, and people live in the east side, there's a bunch of different history, a bunch of different words you want to call things. So it's a very disparate place. But, you know, it's home. It's where I lived my entire life, and it's kind of where I've always been interested in doing stuff in.
In your part of town, which I assume is east side, if you were going to tell us a little micro history of the east side anarchist story, what would that look like?
Well, I mean, if I wanted to go like far back enough, I can like talk about someone like the fact that Magon used to live around the LA east side, but that's not that interesting. It's a little interesting. I mean, he had a commune in Echo Park, which is technically not the east side. You know, the history as far as, you know, the east side is mostly one that's married to the Chicano movement. So that's not very anarchist, really. There's a lot of interesting things that did happen, but it's not very outright, you know, anti-authoritarian. But at least for myself, you know, the history of my experience with, you know, anarchist politics in Los Angeles, you know, arose out of punk. You know, there was a huge, and probably still is like a huge punk scene, and a mostly completely, you know, not white punk scene in the east side of Los Angeles.
Yeah, I think most people are surprised when they go there and experience how true that is. Like, it's not white.
So that was kind of like, you know, a weird bubble I grew up in. Where, you know, that was all I did when I was young. When I was in the teenagers, I was, like, going to shows, putting on shows, playing in bands, and that's all I did. And it really is a bubble that people maybe now realize that it exists and that we were doing things, you know, pretty differently. Then when I encountered, you know, anarcho-punk, which was mostly, like, white punks from Ventura, the Valley, Orange County, Inland Empire, you know, their vision or idea of what punk was a very, very different thing. You know, I came out of, you know, the anarcho-punk scene once I got in touch with that. And then I guess, you know, I can trace where, you know, where my politics changed to a community center run by some friends known as Floricanto. And that's where I met all kinds of ideas, all kinds of people coming through in a very interesting way. And then in their own style, you know, which is something that I'm very influenced by.
Yeah, absolutely. It was an amazing project. Yeah. It actually seemed to pull off without moralizing a lot of the things that people always wanted, like having the neighborhood kids integrated into the space and things like that.
Yeah, and I think it's because, you know, I don't know if they want to say their names, but, you know, the people behind the project were from the neighborhood.
Right.
You know, you could say that they were those kids growing up in the neighborhood. Maybe they didn't grow up in that specific neighborhood, but, you know, for them, it was real. You know, they weren't just people that moved into Los Angeles and decided they're going to, you know, radicalize, you know, the proletarian children. You know, it was a very different thing. I wish it still existed because, you know, I think there's a big need in LA right now for a space that is, you know, adjacent to, you know, anarchist ideas, because it doesn't exist right now. You know, there's a lot of like leftist spaces, activist type spaces, which wouldn't, you know, want to be associated with, you know, much more interesting politics. But yeah, that's kind of, you know, where, you know, I learned about the situation is the ultra left, insurrectionary anarchists, and all of that, you know, the more interesting stuff, than the Kropotkin that I was reading, or Bakunin, or, you know, all these other people.
Yeah, I mean, of course, I think about this quite a bit, because we almost have the opposite problem here in Berkeley, where we have this space that's existed for decades, right? And so there's this class of people who run that space, who are the people who you absolutely need to keep a place like that open. In other words, they're extremely stubborn, they're very weird, and they just grind out the logistics of like how to pay rent every month, and they're very resistant to outside forces who would change the culture or the environment at all. So any young kids who come in who have like a lot of energy and want to make a difference, they make it very challenging, very difficult for them to do it. And so it's like, you know, these spaces are absolutely needed. But within capitalism, the kind of personality types and the kind of logistics you need to have to keep something like that open is the opposite of sort of the inspirational sort of atmosphere that you want to create in an environment like this.
No, really, absolutely. No, it is. I mean, you know, I talk about it with friends now, and I hate being that person that keeps talking about 10 years ago in L.A., when the rents were cheaper, you know, and, you know, the possibilities of opening up a space just seem like, oh, just get a couple people together, raise a little money, and it happens. You know, now it's like an impossibility. It cannot happen in L.A. anymore.
That model, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
And the, I guess that you all have done, like, as a group of people, sort of ex-Floricanto people, it seems like a lot of you have become really interested in what I would call the art movement.
Uh-huh. Explain. And,
well, there's a couple of things I would point to, like the event that happened last year that was sort of like an anti-event to the art book fair that happened last year, and then you did, and some of you participated in this anti-gentrification action, specifically pointing to art galleries and sort of moneyed art interests as they came to town, and I just wanted you to speak to that a little bit, because, of course, when the situations were first becoming sort of a phenomenon or something that people had heard of, they, you know, people who were interested in the fact that they were sort of the tail end of the radical art movement, you know, that sort of has had its origins 100 years ago in Dada. But sort of since the situation has sort of been lost from view, the connection between radical politics and the art scene mostly doesn't exist, and I would say most of the English-speaking world. And so it's a little unusual that you all in Los Angeles seem to be more interested or more connected to that.
Yeah, I think it has to do, because it's probably like my own influence of, like, you know, I took the situation as seriously, and I could see how art has been mobilized in Los Angeles, you know, in favor of capital, you know, in the most like direct real estate speculation way, like in a very real direct way. And I also, as far as, you know, the NAW Fair, which happened in February, which seems like a lifetime ago.
This year?
It was this year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So, for people who don't know, it was sort of like an anti-LA art book fair. And it happened. It's its intentions were like kind of varied because the group that produced it, LA Onda, was very varied. We didn't have like a solid political position, and that was fine. And so I think some of us were interested in like just fucking with artists in a very just like petty way. And so we had, you know, this weird book fair that had, you know, insurrectionary anarchist stuff, communization stuff, and weird Latino punk objects and things like that. And what was interesting is that people were super into it. And they were like, the LA art book fair sucks. This is like it, you know. And it made me think about how something a friend of mine, you know, told me, you know, if you want to change culture, if you're interested in doing that, you have to engage with that culture.
Sure.
In a very real way. And I saw that, I'm like, wow, you know, this had like a weird of thing in an effect in Los Angeles. It like rippled out, you know, it had like a real effect. And it was like the action of like 6, 7, 8 people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, not a big group, not a federation, not a whatever. We just wanted to do this weird thing, and I think that because people saw that LA Onda did that, we were invited to participate in some fashion, whatever way we wanted to do with, you know, the anti-gentrification stuff, like specifically targeting art galleries that have cropped up in Boyle Heights, and that's how we got, you know, so we started to. For a while, you know, to work with that struggle.
Yeah, I it's interesting to have the conversation just as a 2016 conversation, but it does seem like the connection to the public school, the LA public school, that some of you have, also sort of had an arty feel to it. I guess because the public school is also an art gallery, and perhaps the direction that Sandpaper Books took was more of a arty direction. It's just sort of interesting that as a group, this is something that's been more interesting to you all than it has been for most people in most towns.
I think, well, I mean, I wouldn't call the public school an art gallery. It's more, it's a lot of artists and like radical artists, however you want to call them, they participate in the space. So the events that happen, the people that get invited, you know, are reflective of that. You know, when I was a part of it, I was doing anti-work stuff, you know, so I think it's reflective of the people who participate in it. And
sure.
And for some reason in right now, especially I guess you could say in Los Angeles or even broadly in California, there's a lot of interest by people who are, whether our historians, our professors, whatever, and also interested in things like communization.
Right.
And we don't understand why. And, you know, and some of these people, you know, yeah, they're my friends. And I'm just like, I'm interested in like how this happened. Like, and I assume it, you know, it happened through the universities at some point, somehow.
Sure.
And
doesn't that one translator work at an art college? Jason
Smith? Yeah.
Yeah, Jason Smith. So he's in the LA area, right?
Yeah, yeah, he is in Los Angeles area. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I don't think his impact is nothing. I think he's had a real impact.
No, yeah. I mean, he's translated a lot of things. So I think so because of the people who are, you know, producing these things, translating these things. So I think that colors the way things play out. I mean, interestingly enough, 3 years ago, some of us were in Paris and we had a meeting with Gilles Dauvet. Which was interesting. And, you know, we asked him, you know, or one of us asked him, you know, what do you think about the fact that so many art professors in the U.S. are interested in communization? And he said, like, I don't understand what's happening. But he said something in French, you know, ils ne sont que les cums sur la vague, you know, they are but the froth on the wave, you know.
Uh-huh.
Like, they're there, they're doing their thing, but, you know, that's not obviously, you know, my target or like who I'm trying to get to, you know?
Yeah.
So,
just to take that one step further. So do you have a group of people that you know of at all in the LA area that sort of have become fascinated or worshipful of the Invisible Committee and or Tikkun?
I think, I mean, not really. I think people are interested in the Invisible Committee, I think, and it's partly because of the coming insurrection, you know.
Sure.
and that moment, and all the stuff that happened around that time and after that time. And so I think that's when people started like, oh, I should read Tikkun, I should read this, I should read that. But I don't think, as far as I know, there aren't any like outright Tikkunists in Los Angeles who want to do like the whole, you know, classical, you know, Tikkunist sort of form of action in Los Angeles.
I mentioned them mostly, I mean, because they are the inheritors of the of some of the energy of the SI. You know, I found that in general, the SI has sort of fallen out of favor amongst young radicals, and that energy is now a Tikkunist energy. And you know, Tikkun is sort of, they nibble on the edges of the communization trend. I actually consider them to be more interesting than communization, but that's a sort of another topic. But the thing that's fascinating about them, the Invisible Committee et al., is that they're not artists. You know, in France,
yeah,
they just don't have that thing going on at all.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah.
Now, obviously, in America, you know, the same art professors that like communization theory also like de Kooning.
Yeah, I mean, when the public school did like this, we hosted the semiotext release of to our friends. The person who was like there from semiotext was an art professor.
Uh-huh.
You know, and that very much like colored, you know, the way she read to our friends versus how I would have read, you know, to our friends. So, yeah.
Well, let's totally change gears, because obviously we've gone far astray from sort of the goal of this particular hour.
All right.
When we, so as I'll tell in the write up of this episode, we recorded this once before. And the recording didn't sound very good. It had lots of interruptions and problems, and I think that this one is going to sound better. But there were a couple topics that we talked about last time that I guess I just at least want to touch on again. And this is something, for me, you wrote this thing about on your Facebook wall that I found really provocative, that was basically about not wanting to use the C word anymore, meaning communist. And
yeah.
And I have been myself very, I mean, for a long time, there's so many ways to start this conversation, but I'll start it this way. A lot of people who are in our political space who invest in it tend to basically be copying something that they see, that they think is happening in Europe.
Okay.
And so in Europe, most people who call themselves anarchists, I actually wouldn't necessarily associate myself with. A lot of them are very traditional and old school in their anarchism. The federations and a lot of the activity that's done under the red and black flag, by and large, isn't something that I'm interested in, and it's what I would call first wave anarchism, or the anarchism of the Spanish Civil War. And while there, you know, in the past 10 years, perhaps, has been an increase in people who sort of want to talk about insurrectionary anarchism, there's still, to my eyes, a little fuddy-duddy about how it is that they approach these questions, and they sort of maybe focus more than I do on formal definitions of what the terms mean, and they have a lawyerly affect to them.
Yeah.
But of course, communists, you know, are even worse, because I don't know as much on the European stage about communists, but you know, first of all, there's a shitload more state communists over there than there is here in the U.S. And so that absolutely muddies the water to what an anti-state communist perspective would look like. And then to make it even worse, nobody there calls themselves an anti-state communist, right? They call themselves an autonomous Marxist, a left communist, or an ultra-left communist. And these terms, you know, almost have no meaning in the U.S. I mean, there are literally dozens of people who even understand this terminology in the U.S. context. You know, whereas you could arguably say that there are thousands who are talking about this stuff in the European context. And so there's lots of reasons to abandon both of these words, right? I mean, the whole motivation for people to call themselves autonomous in the first place was to avoid the baggage and the legacy and the history of these words, and that was in the 80s.
Yes.
And so to me, I'm always open to have these conversations about, like, why is it that we do and don't choose to use words? Because, you know, I perhaps use the word anarchism in an unfair way, you know, like I basically use the word because I feel, well, I don't want to overstate the case, but I feel like I'm empowered to change the definition of what it means to be an anarchist. Therefore, I'll call myself an anarchist. But yeah. That's sort of, you know, but a lot of people don't feel that powerful. anyway, so let's at least hear why you brought this issue up.
Because I'm thinking about, like, a lot of what, you know, you're saying, and how, you know, these terms change over time and out of context, or they arise, you know, they're different within different contexts. Like, in the European context, obviously, you know, no one calls themselves really an anti-state communist, and that's, I think, that's a term we see here as a way to differentiate, you know, the big C communists from the little C communists. And that's what I see more in the U.S., people just calling themselves communist now with a small C, whereas before I would never ever see that because that was associated with a specific idea, a certain thing. And for a while I was like, oh, this seems like a term that, you know, I can be okay with, and also still call myself an anarchist. I'm okay with, like, using both, but the context of me questioning the use of either of these terms is one that arose out of thinking about colonialism and thinking about what would, you know, a communist or anarchist society, whatever you want to call it, how would it relate to indigenous people? How would it contribute or still, like, continue certain, you know, colonialism, or would it be something else just because it's communism? Because, you know, I've heard left communists say, you know, it's not going to be colonialism because it's going to be communism and it's going to be great for everybody. And I think that kind of, like, sidesteps a lot of really big things you think through. If you're, like, a really committed communist, anarchist, and an anti-colonialist, you know, it's real easy for people to be like, I want to go to Standing Rock and fight against the pipeline, but not think through the entirety of, you know, the colonial project that is the Americas. And that's part of the reason why, like, the term communist didn't feel sufficient or open enough or explained enough. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, these terms, you know, can just explain one part of who you are, right? And you can use other terms to explain different things. Or to, like, you know, because I think about, like, what these terms you do is, like, they're a shorthand for saying, I want this, I don't want that. And I think, you know, because generally people who consider themselves, like, lowercase, you know, C communists, because they haven't really thought through this idea, I think that's the reason why, you know, sometimes, you know, I recoil from that use, you know.
Sure.
And I think also because for me, an anti-political position is pretty important. And I think one of the benefits of an anti-political position is that it broadens who your, I don't want to say comrades are, who the people who are fighting along
you're talking to. Right.
Yeah. It broadens who is on the side you're on, you know, because a lot of, did you say why?
Yeah.
I think because anti-politics is almost like a lens, you can say, at least for me, where I can see the, you know, the anti-political turn or movement or action in many different instances that are not explicitly, you know, Circle A anarchist or some kind of communist thing, right? And I think it allows you to see more friends out there than enemies to a certain degree. So maybe that's the reason why I use it, because it's a little more optimistic in a certain, in a weird way, where it doesn't require all the people acting out in revolt to be to have a certain kind of political consciousness. You know, you don't need to have read, you know, Capital 1, 2, and 3 to, like, to be in the streets, you know, and to be mad about capitalism or whatever.
Huh.
So that's the way I...
That's interesting. That's really different than how I look at it, because I sort of boil... When I say anti-political, partially what I'm talking about is the fact that an anti-political, for lack of a better language, an anti-political set of principles or goals doesn't look like a political set of goals. And a lot of people, when they, quote-unquote, go to the streets, they don't... They only express themselves in terms of political goals, or they express themselves in a way that someone who wants to machinate human beings absolutely sees them, you know, can do that. Like, does that make sense?
Well, I mean, I think maybe we're just using these terms differently, you know.
No, but that's partial to what we're talking about.
Yeah. So I think when I see people angry in the street, and especially in a way that's very not affiliated with like politics with a capital P, right? They're very much acting beyond the controls of the state or what, you know, a certain respect for private property would be. When I see that, to me, that's anti-political because it's going beyond, you know, the mediation of the state or politics or whatever. That's the way I see when I see things, certain things in the street. Versus, like, let's say, you know, a couple of Saturdays ago, there was this huge march in Los Angeles against Trump, and that was very political because there were people there that were mad that Hillary lost. There were people there that mad about that Bernie was never, you know, in the run. You know, all these things, and that was very, very, very political. Whereas some of the more like nighttime wild marches, tagging, breaking things, you know, burning things, that to me feels a lot more anti-political.
Well, that's interesting. I'm not sure I agree. Just, I guess perhaps I set a higher bar for anti-political because when I see those kids running free, what I see is the Al Sharptons, and I'm sure there's tons of Los Angeles equivalents, who are basically figuring out, they're triangulating how they can benefit from those actions, how they can be the voice of the voiceless, and then benefit as politicians themselves. In other words, I think that the politics of the underclasses or something almost always have their spokespeople. Yeah, and so there's being political in the sense of holding up a sign that might say a name on it, but then there's political in the sense of the action that you're doing is very easily reclaimable by a system that just absolutely functions in that way.
I mean, I can see that. I mean, that, you know, these things can be recuperated. But, I mean, there's always going to be those people who are going to, you know, try to rein in, you know, revolt as something that's much more ideologically coherent, you know, like the way some people call the LA riots the LA uprising or the LA rebellion, right? For me, mm-hmm. that's like, you know, that's a move towards the political versus the anti-political. You know, the idea that everything has to be this very thought out, like rebellion. Like we are organized. It's not that I'm against organized rebellion. I kind of lost my train of thought.
Well, let's actually transverse a little bit. You were going to speak about Chicano nationalism and your experience with it, and I'm sure it might thread these pieces together a little bit for you.
No, yeah. Well, I grew up in a neighborhood called Lincoln Heights, and there it was where, you know, growing up in the 80s, where I first learned about the Chicano movement and also Chicano nationalism that happened, you know, during the 60s and 70s. I had a neighbor who was actually in the Chicano movement, and so I learned a lot from him. He was like my Chicano studies professor, but a lot better. And so like with this legacy, right, growing up and developing a much more anti-authoritarian perspective and anti-state perspective, I started to question the validity of Chicano nationalism from a political idea, and also from a sort of analyzing the colonialism that happens within Chicano nationalism.
Can you give like a Chicano activity in Los Angeles 101? Because I mean, speaking for myself, I've maybe heard the story once, and that was like 20 plus years ago. And I'm sure for most of our listeners, like, you know, in the Bay Area, I hear about the Black Panthers all the time. What's the thing that still hits the newspapers in Los Angeles that pertains to the Chicano movement?
Well, I mean, the Chicano movement has effectively, for a long time, had been like a movement towards the university, a movement for higher education. And this is like, you know, exemplified by Mecha. Which, you know, as soon as, you know, the revolutionary potential of the Chicano movement started to, like, taper out, everyone's like, we have to learn about our history, we need to send Chicanos and Chicanas to the universities, we need to make Chicano studies departments. And so that's where it lived for a while. And, you know, that was where my critique of, you know, of that first, of Chicano nationalism first came in when I confronted Mecha, and then, you know, I'm confronted with the idea, like, why the university when the university is so fucking terrible? So, but now you have groups like the Brown Berets, which is an old group, right?
Yeah.
Old group. As far as I know, there's no real continuity now between the groups that exist now and the groups that existed before. There's a certain a lot of them, they follow you know, the original 10-point program of, you know, the Brown Berets, which is probably like the least radical of any 10-point program of any political group that existed in the 60s and 70s. And so, and also there's like a variety of different Brown Beret groups in Los Angeles.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so there's, I think there's like the East LA Brown Berets, and there's another group, and there was a lot of turmoil because one of the groups, I forget which one, was outed for like pretty much being like a guy telling women, like Brown Beret women, what to do, and that it was his group, and he got called out for being, you know, a misogynistic, patriarchal dickhead. Which is something that happened to the Brown Berets in the past too, you know, because, you know, it's very militarized, you know, image. You know, they got the, you know, the berets, they got the their uniforms. You know, at some point, I think some of them had guns. So that's what you see in LA. There's also other like small groups that still exist, like La Raza Unida Party, Barrio del Union del Barrio. Like, there's all these like smaller groups that are kind of Marxist Leninist-y that, you know, put forth like a Chicano nationalist position. And briefly, the Chicano nationalist position is that the American Southwest is the original homeland of the Aztecs, and because Chicanos are descendants from Aztecs, then it is our homeland, and we need to take it back, you know, and kick out, you know, the gringos and whoever else. Even though, like, this, you know, this is pretty obviously ignores, you know, indigenous people that have been in the Southwest for millennia.
Sure, and underfoot of the Aztecs the whole time.
Yeah, and also not every person of Mexican descent is of, you know, so-called Aztec descent.
Sure.
There's a plurality of different indigenous nations in what is now Mexico. So there's a lot of flaws in this ideology. And a lot of people, they've tried to work this out with like certain variations and certain new terms. But it's a pretty like dead in the water ideology. That for some reason still exists, you know, and some of my friends and I would like to call them dinosaurs because we can't believe they're still around, you know? And I think people get into it because the image of the Brown Beret looks, you know, radical.
It's as cool as the Black Panthers. I mean,
yeah, they got the whole look down. So, you know, and it's a rating. It's an ideology. You can just hook up into it. You can get the Brown Beret, and you can feel really cool. And I think that's the extent of the Brown Berets. Of course, now I think the Brown Berets have done some stuff around like boycotting Driscoll's and other like actions. But generally speaking, as far as like what I would call, you know, revolutionary action in Los Angeles, there is none from like the Chicano nationalist movement. You know, it's all just kind of like real basic identity politics. That's about it.
Yeah, I I'm working on a book project right now that involved a series of interviews, and there's a couple interviews I did that were with people from my childhood that I think a lot of people will find very interesting, because it basically tells the story that you're just telling about the Chicano nationalists about AIM in the 70s. So these are Native people who live in Michigan, and they're basically talking about how much the formation of AIM, you know, was absolutely predicated on the rise of the Black Panthers, and basically Natives were like, hey, wait a second, we should do that too. And you know, how for Michigan Indians, who are more or less a completely genocided group of people, that they're basically looking west and seeing Wounded Knee happen, and, you know, more or less like this was this incredible moment in everybody's life who I talked to, just, you know, having this like this incredible thing that happened somewhere else, but then the rest of their lives, more or less, they're living in the shadow of this one moment. anyways, had some similarities. And the fact is that, you know, of course, all these groups did come into existence topping the Black Panthers in these sort of, especially in this aesthetic way. It's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's kind of the failure of the Brown Berets is that they couldn't see beyond themselves. You know, they only looked to the capacity of self-organizing La Raza, you know, how they refer to, you know, people of Mexican descent. And they couldn't see beyond that, and they couldn't see beyond their idealization of the Aztecs, their idealization of Mexico, you know, where at the same time the Mexican state is actively killing radicals, like murdering.
Absolutely, I mean, like, and the Mexican state is crazy, yeah.
Yeah, you know, you have 68 and, you know, the student massacre, and, you know, and continue to do this throughout the 70s against, you know, other, you know, insurgent, you know, left insurrectionary movements in Mexico. So there's a lot of blind spots, you know, where, and I think it's, you know, it's natural, you know, for, you know, people who live in, you know, in diaspora, you could say, to like idealize the homelands. And yeah. whereas in Mexico, you know, a lot of the things that Chicano nationalists do in the U.S. is laughable. When you speak to actual Mexican radicals, you know, sure. They're like, you guys are like way behind, you know, like as far as like looking through race, colonialism, all kinds of things. Yeah.
Yeah, I we'll talk about this another time, but at some point I would love to hear your thoughts on the eco-extremist movement. You probably don't follow LPC enough to know sort of all the things we're working on, but we're putting out this journal at the end of this quarter that's pretty much like it's entirely about the Mexican radical movement that's happening that very few people are paying attention to here in the U.S.
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes I don't read that stuff because I'm worried about getting like pinged, you know, getting like,
of course,
because I remember the Green Scare in the early 2000s, you know, in the 2000s.
Yeah.
And I remember people getting picked up for like saying random stuff. And I'm like, I don't need to be reading about eco extremism right now.
Yes. Yeah. Sometimes one wonders if someone, quote unquote, actually read what's between the book, the pages of many of the things that we put out.
Yeah, I mean,
we really, yeah.
No, I just specifically the eco extremism stuff because, you know, from what I imagine, there's not a big space between ideas and action when it comes to the eco extremist movement versus, you know, other, you know, movements. So I think that's the reason why sometimes I'm like, I should not, like, I'm just not going to relate to it too much, you know? Yeah.
Well, there are some paper products coming out that perhaps will not be as dangerous to touch.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I think that's actually a pretty good start to the variety of things that we have to talk about. Obviously, you know, one topic I really look forward to talking about with you is some of the writing that you've done under various pseudonyms, so we won't necessarily point to it, but we'll point to some websites. And then at some point, I really want to get into it about colonization. It feels like this is a conversation that we can have that I think a lot of people are excited to hear, and I'm excited to have, and I have no idea sort of where the beginning, middle, or end looks like, which normally when I start a conversation, I have a pretty good idea as to how it's going to end. But yeah.
No, I'm into it. I mean, I feel like maybe between now and then I'll do some more reading so I can feel a little more
sure.
comfortable to talk about that. Yeah.
Okay, well, so this is great. This is the end of episode 38 of The Brilliant Podcast. You can always email us at thebrilliant@thebrilliant.org, and of course our URL is thebrilliant.org, and yeah, thank you very much for your time, Julio.
All right, thank you, Aragorn.